Uehino Amadonai Eloheinu Aleinu Ma'asedeno Konona Aleinu Ma'asedeno Konaneu. Shalom Aleichem, Beruchim Abayim, welcome everyone. Be'ezrat Hashem, in this lesson I want to address an interesting topic. I want to study with you the biblical book, the prophet Isaiah, in the 7th and 8th chapters, which speak about an event in ancient Israel, wherein which the prophet Isaiah has a very interesting discussion with King Ahaz, who's the king of Judah, over certain political events that is occurring there. These chapters obviously have their place in history, and we will learn it in accordance to how the texts were written, what they really meant. But what makes Isaiah in the 7th chapter most unique is that we find a verse in this chapter taken and adopted by the Christian gospel writers, specifically Matthew, and from this is extrapolated a Christian belief that their Messiah, Yeshu, was somehow born of a virgin. Now, this concept of a virgin birth is foundational to the Christian religion. In all Protestant teachings, the virgin birth is one of the many claimed miracles that Christianity always claims comes from our Jewish Bible, and therefore is validation for their beliefs. Both Matthew and later in the Gospel of Luke claim that Mary, Yeshu's mother, was a virgin and was divinely conceived. These ideas go way, way back to the foundations of Christianity. It's found in both what's called the Nicene and the Apostle Creeds. Those were the original tenets of faith which founded Christianity. And just as an interesting side note, in Islam, they also hold that Mary was a virgin. Judaism, on the other hand, with regards to Yeshu, has expounded a teaching that actually Mary, Yeshu's mother, was somehow involved in an illicit relationship with a Roman soldier by the name of Pantera, and that that was his true father. Now, whether that story is historical, or a response, a denigrating response to the fantasiacal claims of a virgin birth, which I might add is a very foreign concept to Judaism, but a very familiar concept with paganism of the time. Who can say? In other words, I can only state that the story presented from the ancient sources is there. I don't know if there is any historical evidence that could validate it. Now, an interesting point also on the side is that within the concept of Roman Catholicism, which remember has always been the church outside of Protestantism, they hold that Mary, Yeshu's mother, was called a perpetual virgin, that she remained a virgin throughout the rest of her life. Now, that proposes interest because there is reference in the Christian traditions of Yeshu having brothers. Now, could Yeshu have brothers from his mother if she was a continual virgin? That is an issue I will leave to the Catholic theologians to discuss and come to their own conclusions. In this lesson, I want to discuss the historical Isaiah, what the verse was really all about. And only then turn to Matthew's use of this verse and try to come to an understanding of what exactly he had meant. Because please understand where, as an Orthodox rabbi, I am coming from. Matthew, from what we can understand, was a faithful student of his teacher, his Rebbe, Yeshu. A point that must be understood is that Yeshu and his original followers were very radical, right-wing, extremist, orthodox Jews of their day. And again, I always emphasize that the major division between our sages and Yeshu was not political, or it was not spiritual or religious, but actually political. But that's besides the point. His original followers were zealots, the Sakkari, the Birionim, known in the language of the Talmud. These people were not ignorant, and therefore were very much embracing of the Torah path. And therefore, for me, as a rabbi, to consider that they, as much as we disagree with the fundamentals of who they are and what they stood for, I still find it very hard to believe that they would be so willing to embrace pagan concepts that are foreign to Torah. So I have to be able to look at Matthew as a fellow Jew, as divergent as we might be, and ask the question, what exactly are you saying when you're using these words? In order for us to understand Matthew, Matthew never studied Christianity. Matthew only had before him the same Isaiah that we have before us now. So before we can step into Matthew's shoes or Matthew's head, we first have to step into his studies, our studies, the book of Isaiah, the 7th chapter. Let us turn and let us study this material, and then we can take from this where we're going to go. Isaiah chapter 7. And for the record here, I am using an English translation called the Living Nach. Nach stands for Nevi'im in Hebrew. Actually, it's Nevi'im and Ketuvim. I am using the volume called The Later Prophets, a new translation based on traditional Jewish sources, published by Mosnayim Publishing Corp. out of New York and Jerusalem. Isaiah chapter 7 therefore reads, and the reason why I chose this commentary, this translation, it's the easiest reading and most true to the Hebrew origins. It states here, in the days of King Ahaz, the son of Jotham, the son of Uzziah of Judah, King Rezin of Aram is Syria, and King Pekah, the son of Remaliah of Israel, marched out to attack Jerusalem, but they could not conquer it. Now, let's understand the political setting. As we know, the nation of Israel was split into two between what we call the northern and southern kingdom. The southern kingdom became known as Judah, the northern kingdom known as Israel. The house of David were in charge of the kingdom of Judah, and the northern kingdom had its own selection of kings. In spite of the fact that the northern and the southern kingdoms were both Israel, the children of Israel, couldn't really call them all Jews, because Jews' name referred to Judah, but name would apply by modern standards. The relationship between the northern and southern kingdom was anything but friendly. So we see here a situation that the northern kingdom actually joined forces with the pagan Assyrians, the pagan Aramaeans, which is Syria, modern-day Syria. And from there, these two, northern Israel and ancient Syria, joined to attack the kingdom of Judah. And they made many skirmishes, they were capturing border towns, and needless to say, they came to Jerusalem, but they could not take it. So the house of David, the leadership of the nation of Judah, was informed what was going on. Aram has joined with Ephraim. Ephraim, of course, the name given to all northern tribes. The king's heart and the heart of his people trembled like the trees of the forest shaking in the wind. I mean, good gosh, their brothers have just, in essence, betrayed them, joining with a higher force. From a military point of view, the house of Judah here is very much concerned. So when you have a vital threat to national security, it's very good that you can have a prophet from Hashem who can give you insight and information as to what's happening, what's going to happen, and what you can do. So God says to Isaiah, go out to Ahaz, you and your son, whose name is Shar Yeshuv, the edge of the conduit of the upper pool by the road of Fuller's Field. And you can ask, gee, where is that? And every commentator asks, where is that? And apparently no one has any archaeological, historical evidence to validate the point, this is where. So it just is the place where he was told to meet him. So God says, Isaiah, this is what I want you to tell him. Be careful, but be calm and don't be frightened. Don't lose heart because of these two firebrands smoking in anger. Rezin and the Arameans and the son of Remaliel. He doesn't even call him by his first name. The prophecy continues. Since Aram, Ephraim, and the son of Remaliel have plotted evil against you, saying, let's march against Judah, destroy it, break it into and take it for ourselves, and let us appoint some guy named Ben-Tabal king there. There are a number of questions of who this guy is, whether he was an Israelite or an Aramean, doesn't really matter. The nature of the prophecy is that God is recounting what the plans of, you know, conquering are and what they intend to do. So the Lord God says, this will not come to pass, and it will not happen. Phew! I'm sure that made the king of Judah feel a whole lot better. Or at least it would if he was a religious man who had trust and faith in God. King Ahaz was not known to be the most righteous and holy of kings. So even though he had the words of the prophet, you know, I guess that's okay, but hey, what can we say? When a person doesn't have faith in God, then I guess even the word of God directly only is going to have so much of a meaning. So, the prophecy continues that true, the head of Aram is Damascus, and the head of Damascus is Rezin, right? And the head of Ephraim is Samaria, in other words, the capital, and the head of Samaria is the son of Remaliah. But here the text states, in another 65 years, Ephraim will cease to be a people. And if you do not believe, you will not survive. In other words, it states here that God's already planned for the wiping out of the northern kingdom. 65 years from now, Ahaz won't be king then, but it says, not only do you not have to worry about this present attack, you don't have to worry about the northern kingdom at all. They're going to cease to exist within the next couple of generations, generation and a half. They're going to be gone. That's pretty radical. Can you imagine if a prophecy came today wherein states, don't worry about, growing Islamic terror, or one of the other world nations becoming a superpower. Give them another generation, and they're going to collapse under their own weight. They're all going to be gone. You go, oh, really? Oh, gee, I'd love to see that. And it's not real to you until you actually, using our terms, see it on the news. That's the way prophecy was received then. They were much more concerned with present events, and they were frightful. Not understanding so from someone who lacks spirituality. Recognizing this, what can I say? Lack of faith. God, through, of course, Isaiah, speaks to the king Ahaz and says, request a sign for yourself from God your Lord. Request it in the depths or from high above. And Ahaz says, I will not ask. I will not test God. Now, our sages explain this as saying, you know something? God himself told Ahaz, go ahead, ask for any sign that you want. He says, oh no, I'm not going to test God. Very pious words. Right? The law actually states we're not supposed to test God. But they state here that Ahaz was not even willing to entertain a concept of a religious miracle. So he veiled himself behind religious, you know, pompousness. Oh, I'm not going to test God. Where in reality, what he was saying was, I don't believe God can do it. And therefore, he didn't want to create an opportunity where in which a miracle could occur that in essence would reinforce religion in the people. So he said, no, we don't need this religious involvement here. I don't want to test, I'm not going to test God, etc. But now Isaiah says, all right, house of David, listen. It's not enough for you that you aggravate men? Must you aggravate my God as well? Isaiah understood very clearly what Ahaz's intent was by denying a sign. He knew that this wasn't some, you know, statement of piety. He knew what this was, and he just says, all right, it's not enough that you bother people by not making them religious, by taking religion away from them. Now you're going to aggravate God? You're in such a precarious military situation. God is going to come to your aid, and you don't even want to meet him halfway? So he says, therefore, God is going to give you a sign. And here's our famous verse. The woman will conceive and bear a son, and she will call him Emmanuel. Now, this is a literal translation of the original Hebrew. The woman, the original Hebrew word is Alma, which means a young maid. Okay? It's very important we recognize that. She will conceive and bear a son, and she will call him Emmanuel, which means God's with us. He will eat curds and honey when he learns to reject evil and choose good. For before the boy learns to reject evil and choose good, the land whose two kings you dread will be abandoned. God will bring upon you, your people, and your father's house days whose like have never come since the days of Ephraim separated from Judah, and that is the king of Assyria. On that day, God will whistle to the flies at the edge of the ditches of Egypt and to the bees in Assyria. All of them will come in a camp in desolated wadis, the clefts of the rocks, and all the thorn brakes and thistles. On that day, God will shave your head and the hair of your legs with a hired razor, who is the king of Assyria, at the banks of the Euphrates, and he will also destroy your beard. Now, what on earth is this all about? The prophecy is given within a context. Ahaz refuses a sign from God that God is going to neutralize the present force of northern Israel and Syria. Isaiah says, God's going to send you a sign anyway. A child is going to be born. His name is going to be God is with us. And you're going to see by the time he's old enough to choose between good and evil, which is still a young age. The nation of Assyria, not Aram, which is Syria, Assyria, which is kind of like modern-day Iraq, they're going to come, and they're going to take over both Aram and northern Israel. And therefore, they're going to wipe them out. And even Egypt, who is in cahoots with Aram, they're all going to gather against the Assyrians, and the Assyrians are going to wipe them out. And if you remember from your biblical history, the Assyrians swarmed the entire Middle East, including the land of Judah. And they would have conquered even Jerusalem. But later, in the days of King Hezekiah, there was the miracle where the entire armies of the general of the Assyrians, Sennacherib, his entire army was wiped out overnight by some miracle of God. That is another story. But here, the prophecy is more urgent and more imminent. In the aftermath of this Assyrian invasion, it says, on that day each man will raise a calf and two sheep, and people will eat curds because there is so much milk. Everyone remaining in the land will eat curds and honey. And that day, every place where there is 1,000 vines worth 1,000 shekels will become thorns and thistles in that part, northern Israel. People will come there with bows and arrows. Indeed, all the land will be thorns and thistles. But all the mountains cultivated with a hoe will not be touched by the fear of thorns and thistles. Cattle will graze there, and sheep will pasture there. the difference, of course, between the northern and southern kingdoms and their eventual outcome. Now, that's the prophecy. Again, the sign of the neutralizing of the fear of Aram and northern Israel would be that this woman is going to get pregnant and have a son. When does this occur? Let's read the next chapter, chapter 8. Now, God said to me, of course, he's talking to Isaiah, take a large roll and write on it in clear script, for Maher Shalal Chashbaz. Okay? And it says here, I am summoning reliable witnesses, Ariah the priest, and Zechariah the son of Yerubbaal. And it says here, I approach the prophetess who conceived and bore a son. That is the fulfillment right there of the prophecy that he just spoke verses ago in 7:14. And it says here, name him Maher Shalal Chashbaz. God told me, for before the boy knows how to say father and mother, the spoils of Damascus and the booty of Samaria will be brought before the king of Assyria. Again, before the little child even knows how to talk, before he can choose between good and evil, he's going to know that this child is going to be the sign of promise that God is with the people. Now, some people say, how is it that in Isaiah 7:14 it states that the mother, it says she will call his name Emmanuel, but here Isaiah calls him by this long name, Maher Shalal Chashbaz. Boy, that's a mouthful. Well, traditionally it has been understood and known, mind you, throughout biblical history, that mothers and fathers give their children individual names. We call them today first names and middle names, but in olden days it was very common. We see, for example, Solomon had many different names, King Solomon, son of David. We find in his writings, in Proverbs, he calls himself by different names, as well as in other places. This is a very common ancient tradition. So the fact that his mother would say God is with us, and his father would call him something else, is in no way contradictory. The importance of the birth of this child is that it was a sign of expediency, that by the time this child would get to be a certain age, that all of the prophecies of Isaiah would be fulfilled. So what is so miraculous about this? Why is this such a sign? Well, the prophetess, apparently, it states very clearly, says, I approach the prophetess who conceived. It's apparently Isaiah's wife. That's it. She herself is a prophetess. Apparently, when Isaiah went and spoke with King Ahaz, he went with his wife, who was associate prophets, prophetess. There were prophetesses in ancient Israel like there were prophets, male and female. Prophecy was equally received by both. Isaiah's wife clearly was a prophetess and very possibly went with him to speak to King Ahaz. And the sign was, he pointed there and says, look, she's going to get pregnant and she's going to have a son. Now, how would you know that? Just because you are intimate doesn't mean you have a child. And just because you're intimate and you get pregnant doesn't mean the child's going to be a male. But he says, nope, this is it. She's going to have a child. It's going to be a male. And by the time he's able to say Abba or Ima, you're going to see what's going to happen. That's pretty definitive. That's pretty much a very clear statement in time and space about how things are going to be. This is exactly the history of what happened here. And so, God spoke to me again. Since this people has rejected the slow-flowing waters of Siloam and preferred Rezin and the son of Remaliah, again, metaphorical language because of how they reject the Torah, etc. and so on, all the prophecies are given here about how God is going to punish the northern kingdom.
Continuing here, indeed God spoke to me, holding me with a firm hand. He warned me not to follow in the ways of this people, etc. and so on. I don't want to have to read all the different prophecies because I don't want to be distracted by all the punishments that God says he's going to send on the northern house of Israel because of all their sins. But I will conclude where he says here, I will wait for God, even though he's hiding his face from the house of Jacob. I will trust in him. Here I am with the children of Israel. Gave me the, these are the signs and the portents in God by the Lord of hosts who dwells in Mount Zion. All right? So he says, if you are told, seek the mediums and oracles who chirp and groan, that the people may inquire of its gods of the dead on behalf of the living. He says, seek Torah, seek teaching and testimony. Indeed, there is no dawn for those who speak in this way. He's telling people, repent. Don't go around searching through your new age weirdo mysticism, trying to speak with mediums and all that other garbage. Turn to God. You're in a very desperate political military situation. Turn to God. That's the ultimate essence of everything that he is saying here. And the sign that God is with the people is the fact that there's going to have this child born. And by the time he's born, and the time he grows up, and the time he can speak, you're going to see all these things coming to bear. Nowhere is it insinuated that Isaiah's wife is in any way a virgin. We have no record, historical or otherwise, to insinuate he had more than one wife. And if he is already coming with his son, Shar Yashuv, then it's very possible, most likely, that she is the mother of Shar Yashuv, and now she's going to have a second child, therefore discounting any possibility of her being a virgin. Now, this is the way Isaiah has traditionally been understood and taught in Jewish circles. Good gosh, I guess it's the dead time that the book was written. We have here in the rest of the chapter, again, prophecies. But here's something interesting. This is a little outside of our present context, but it's important within our context now to discuss it. Chapter 9, Isaiah gives a prophecy. It says, the people walking in darkness have seen a great light. Light has dawned over those living in a land of gloom. And continuing, just to skip a little bit here in verse 5, it says, for a boy has been born to us, a son has been given to us, and authority rests on his shoulders. Wondrous advisor, mighty God, eternal father, and we'll name him Prince of Peace. He will enjoy abundant authority, peace without end on the throne of David over his kingdom. His kingdom will be firmly established through righteousness and justice now and forever. God's zeal will accomplish this. Who is this? Some say it is King Mashiach. But historically, it has always been interpreted to be a reference to Hezekiah, the king who would have foreseen, or I should say who was king, when again the Assyrians came against Israel. But wait a second, doesn't it say that Hezekiah, his kingdom would be peace and righteousness and all that? Well, indeed it was. Hezekiah, our sages say, was almost the closest to a messianic king, you know, next to King Solomon himself. Indeed, our sages say that God wanted to make Hezekiah to be the Messiah in his day. But because of certain things that were done, it was not accomplished. This is the traditional way of how Isaiah 7 and 8 and even here 9 have always been interpreted. This is the way that any Jew would have come to this material. The child spoken of in Isaiah 14 is clearly the son of Isaiah himself, born by his wife, a second son to Shar Yashuv, and he's born right there in the next chapter. His birth is imminent and important as a sign for the demise of the military threat facing Judah from northern Israel and Syria. There is no reference here, historical, prophetic, or otherwise, to this being some type of a prophetic verse speaking of something to happen hundreds of years in the future, which of course would have had absolutely zero relevance or interest to King Ahaz, who needs immediate military relief from his threat to national security. And therefore, by the fact that this child being born in such a quick time, and by the time he would grow to a certain age, that would be the symbol and sign that indeed the military threat would be obliterated. And obviously it was. And therefore Isaiah could turn to the king and say, I told you so. And therefore sanctify and glorify God's name. To state again, by this time you'll see the change. And everybody would have heard it, everybody would have known it, and they would all have said, thank God, give glory to heaven. But now, let us move up in history. Let us go back to Matthew. Let us understand the man, the times, and his writings. In the days when Yeshu historically walked amongst the Jewish people, the common vernacular language, of course, was Aramaic. The people of the day did know Greek. That was the common vernacular used by the Romans. Did everybody in those days amongst the Jews speak Greek? And the answer most definitely would be, no, they didn't. Greek was the language of the elite class, the sophisticated class, the secular, assimilated class. Those who are of the old school would never speak the language or learn the language. That was considered to be a compromise by many. If you will, compare it today to English. Granted, many in the Orthodox Jewish world, including myself, speak English, whereas many others, including my own teachers, certainly do not. Right, wrong, good, bad is not a discussion here. It's just the historical, actual facts on the ground. So now we have to ask a question. If Matthew was going to be speaking, what language would he normally speak to? According to the Christian tradition, he was a tax gatherer. As a tax gatherer paying taxes, most likely to Judea, because Judea then paid the taxes to Rome, it is not definitive that he would have known Greek, but very possibly that he did. I must grant that, you know, we can only, you know, postulate these things. There is no definitive proof for anything. But the question is important to ask, what language would Matthew have written in? And I think that we can draw a conclusion to state that, again, Matthew accepted as his rabbi, his teacher, Yeshu. Now, Yeshu, mind you, was clearly a radical, very patriotic, right-wing, violent Jew. So violent, so radical, that of course it led to the schism between him, his followers, and the rest of Israel. I do not believe that his followers would be sympathetic to the Greek language any more than they would have been sympathetic to Roman culture, which they fought so vehemently against and died trying to destroy in Israel. And therefore, to think that Matthew would, A, write in that language, which I'm sure his own Rebbe would have despised, and all the more so embrace a concept so foreign to their Torah, which they again despised, I can't see that happening. It just doesn't make sense. But yet we know from the Christian Gospel of Matthew, he states that Yeshu was born of a virgin in fulfillment of the prophecy in Isaiah 7:14. But now here's our problem. The word for virgin is not found in Isaiah 7:14. The child born, the child spoken of is clearly born in Isaiah 8, verse 3. what on earth then is Matthew talking about? It can be argued that Matthew never wrote these words, and that it was a later addition to his words written by Christians intending to embellish the Matthewan gospel. Well, that might be possible. Unfortunately, from the best of my understanding, the oldest intact records of Christian scriptures that we have, I think, dates from the 8th century. We don't have any original documentation. We don't have an original gospel. Unlike Torahs, which we have dating back thousands of years, we just don't have gospels dating back that long. So we can't really state what the original texts had written in them. I am still under the impression, and I believe this is backed up by modern scholarship, that Matthew had to have been written in Aramaic, possibly then translated into Greek when these teachings became of interest to a wider Greek-speaking, lesser than religious, Jewish, or non-Jewish audience. In that case, if that is the case, what then was Matthew trying to state in his original Aramaic? Why is he quoting Isaiah? If he is true to Jewish tradition, which includes absolutely no concept of a virgin birth, what exactly is he saying? Where did this word virgin come from? And whether it's really there in the original Matthew or not is another question. But why is he quoting Isaiah in the first place? Virgin or no virgin? What does it have to do with the issue? For this, we have to understand an aspect of Jewish biblical interpretation. You see, unlike today, where people want to turn to the English translation of the Bible and scream at the top of their lungs how every word is to be taken literally, no Jew has ever, ever taken the Bible literally. We have always known it to be a book more of poetry than prose. It is always a book of an art form rather than absolute documentation. And therefore, like we just read with prophecy, right? This flowery language used by the prophets to describe things. Right? None of this is literal. These are poetic license. That's just the way these things are. This type of interpretation, this type of allegory, metaphor, symbolism, poetry, in Hebrew is traditionally called a midrash, from the word doresh, which means to explain, to expand, and to expound. It is an embellishment. We all do this. This is very common. This is the way stories are told. When we wish to embellish a tale, we find this commonly used throughout all Jewish literature. Matthew, if he had any education whatsoever, would have been educated in his own culture and traditions, which were permeated by this type of literary license. And therefore, it only is logical to conclude that if this is what he learned and this is how he learned, then when he writes, he's going to follow suit. And therefore, when he makes a reference to his Rebbe, his teacher, Yeshu, in relationship to Isaiah, Matthew, and everybody reading his work who knows Isaiah, would clearly understand that this is not some historical reference that he's making. It is certainly not a prophetical reference to Isaiah that he is making, but rather a midrashic reference to Isaiah that he is making. He is not speaking in relationship to a virgin birth or any other kind of birth as much as the meaning of what Isaiah originally was that the child was a symbol of the times, that a present military threat would soon be dissipated and destroyed. By referencing Isaiah and stating that Yeshu was like that, was Matthew's subtle way of stating that Yeshu, or in Yeshu's day, the power of Rome, the present military threat in Matthew's day, would equally be broken and destroyed. That is how I understand what Matthew was saying by relating Yeshu to this verse. However, with the historical development of Christianity and its rejection of its original Jewish origins, the rejection of the original teachings of the Jerusalem church, the Nazarenes, the Ebionites, the followers of James and John and Peter. James, who was always called Yeshu's brother, physical brother, like son of Mary kind of thing. Some say it was from Joseph's first wife and not Mary. But again, let the theologians argue those points. Who cares? But they presented a much different view of things than came later. As history went on, and the Christian message found much more of an embrace in non-Jewish circles than Jewish. Remember, our sages rejected Yeshu based upon his politics, his violence. Paul, who, as we've discussed in previous lessons, may have been intentionally sent by the Sanhedrin with the intent to spiral this pestering problem away from Judaism and Jews, came up with an entirely spiritual interpretation of Yeshu, which was devoid of the political message. This was warmly received by many of the non-Jews of the empire. In the Roman Empire, I believe the percentage was up to 10% were close to Jews or converting to Judaism. So much so that we have a record in the Talmud about even Emperor Nero. We all know Roman history that states that Nero fiddled while Rome burned. They state that Nero became insane towards the end of his life and then disappears from the body of history. Judaism has a little different understanding. They state that Nero himself converted and became a Jew, which in the eyes of the Romans must have been clear insanity, left Rome, and his descendants became great rabbis. That is how much of an influence Judaism was in ancient Rome, and the threat faced by a firebrand political upstart like Yeshu, which led to the Roman overreaction, having to destroy Israel and Judaism completely, or so they tried. But what happens then to all these, well, possibly hundreds of thousands, millions of people who were exposed to Jewish teachings? These compromised versions of Yeshu then also became attached to many of the other religious traditions of the times, the Hindu traditions, the Mithraic traditions, the ancient gods. This problem was addressed even in the second century by the original church fathers, Justin Martyr and the like, who wrote long, long apologies, they were called, telling people, well, the reason why you find teachings of Yeshu that they themselves, the church, is presenting, similar to those found in pagan religions, is because the devil went and filled these ancient religions with all these concepts and ideas so that when you would learn the truth, you would be confused by it. Now, you might take an eye and not be very strongly convinced by such a backward argument of that nature, but that's only those who are of a scholarly mind would think such. For the faithful, that's their answer, that's what they accept, that's what they're taught, that's what they believe. Done. Okay. And therefore, if we find in the Mithraic religions of ancient Persia, or the Hindu religions, concepts and ideas of virgins giving birth, or resurrected beings coming out of trees, or caves as the case may be, those were accepted. The everyday people accepted those ideas. And therefore, of course it could be true of Yeshu. Why not? It's true of everybody else and their religions. But doesn't that take away from its credibility? No, why not? That's the work of the devil that makes you believe that. Oh, okay, fine. So they're wrong and we're right, and that's the way it is. And that's the way religion has always been. Christianity bases itself not upon history, not upon archaeology, not upon evidence, but upon faith. You are taught this is what you believe, and anything that contradicts it, however glaringly obvious, is obviously a demonic deception and a challenge to your faith. God's testing you to see if you're going to be true or not. And therefore, rational analysis is usually put to the wayside. That might be well and good for the rank and file who have to live by faith. And indeed, I do not intend these teachings to be iconoclastic, to challenge that faith. No, I don't. I'm not interested in challenging people's faith. I'm not interested in telling you, you got to believe this or you got to believe that. Frankly, I don't care what people believe. And if they want to believe that Yeshua was born of a virgin, and if they don't want to believe that Isaiah 7:14 says so, go ahead. I don't really care. All I can do is tell you or show you, share with you, if you will, the history. And share with you why we do not necessarily share your faith. But I'm not concerned about issues of theology or doctrine. I am more concerned with your behavior. I'm more concerned of how you act, not upon what you believe. And I do believe that there is enough of foundation, obviously in Judaism, but of course even in Christianity, to validate this as being our common denominator. So with everything that I'm saying here, I can foresee Christian listeners saying, nope, nope, not like that rabbi says, nope. And I said, okay, fine, whatever. I'm not here to challenge the faith of those who want to believe. And I'm saying this over and again because I want to encourage those of you who are listening. Our job is not to be crusaders. We are not on a crusade to make others believe like we do. We are not on a crusade to make others believe anything. So therefore, I offer this information only as explanation, as an understanding and insights. And people can accept or reject them as they like. For a greater explanation of this concept of the virgin birth, you can go on to online encyclopedias like Wikipedia and pull up virgin birth and Christianity and read all about it. I learned from there something interesting, that in the Greek interpretation of the Jewish Bible called the Septuagint, the word used to translate Alma in Isaiah 7:14 could very well have been interpreted into Greek and from Greek into other languages as to mean both a young woman or a virgin. I don't believe that Matthew wrote from Greek. I think he would have written in Aramaic based upon all the ideas that I presented. But nonetheless, I can see where this misinterpretation seeped into Christianity. Now, of course, Christianity holds as an absolute fundamental of their faith the concept of the virgin birth. And even though it is questioned in certain liberal theologies in Christianity today, the traditional Christian view held by the Catholic Church, born-again circles, and all the rest, considers such leniencies to be abomination. So be it. Again, we're not here to challenge or to contradict. We're not here to be iconoclastic. However, with regards to this history of the correct meaning of the word Alma in Isaiah 7:14, this is not subject to contention. You have Bibles, all right, and the original King James Version of the Bible, I believe written in 1611, translated Isaiah and that word as Alma, based upon, of course, their understanding of Matthew. But later versions of the Christian Bible, I believe in the RSV, the Revised Standard Edition, amongst others, have changed the English to appropriately correlate to the authentic Hebrew. In other words, to translate it accurately. Doesn't change their theology. Their theology of a virgin birth has gone through, oh gosh, hundreds of years of progression. Again, codified by the Nicene and apostolic creeds, codified by the church in 325. But again, in the original teachings of James and Peter and John, those who were intimate with Yeshu, never was such a concept mentioned or even entertained. There is even references, and that even when Paul makes mention of the birth of Yeshu, he says born of a woman, but specifically does not say born of a virgin. And some people interpret that as being indicative that maybe he was not aware of this virgin birth concept at the time of his writings. Right? Wrong? True? False? We can leave that to the theologians to discuss. In conclusion, I want to reiterate, this class is not meant to be a bone of contention. It is only meant to be an exegesis and understanding. And I please pray that everybody would take it as such. For a rabbi to explore concepts in Christianity, historically this is unfortunately had to have been done in disputation and confrontation, because rabbis have always been attacked, challenged by Christian authorities, and have been forced into a position of defense. I do not want to go on the defense or offense. I do not want to offend or challenge. I only want to explain, and I ask that this material be accepted in that spirit of building bridges that I offer it. So on that note, let me conclude this, and God be willing, we'll continue in a series of other ideas and concepts going back into the Jewish Bible to understand foundations and to understand how these could have been understood Jewishly by the Jewish authors and how they have been evolved through the concept of the non-Jewish Christian writings. Let's conclude then. Baruch Adonai L'olam. Amen. Amen.